Welcome back, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Matone Center for Law and Religion at St. John's University in New York. And this is another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website, which is the Law and Religion Forum, and also on streaming platforms like Apple iTunes and Spotify and Android. If you like us, please subscribe. Well, our guest this week is Daniel McCarthy. Dan is the editor-in-chief of Modern Age, an opinion journal founded by Russell Kirk in 1957 and published nowadays by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And Dan is also a contributing editor at the American Conservative. He writes a column for the New York Post, and his work has appeared in many other publications as well, including the New York Times. Dan, delighted to have you as a guest with us today.
Thanks, Mark.
So I asked Dan to join us today to discuss his really interesting essay in last month's Modern Age titled The Other Nuns, and that's N-O-N-E-S, that's not N-U-N-S. Now, this essay caught my attention because as someone who studies the law of church and state, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what we call religious nuns. And religious nuns are the growing percentage of Americans, especially young Americans, who tell surveyors that they have no religious affiliation, that their religious affiliation is none. Now, the percentage of religious nuns today is somewhere around 20% of Americans, depending on which survey you look at, and that amounts to well over 60 million of us. Just to give you an idea, 50 years ago, the percentage of Americans who denied having a religious affiliation was only 5%. So that's a huge change over the course of one or two generations. And because most Americans are Christians historically, the ranks of the nuns are mostly ex-Christians of some kind. That is, the rise of the nuns reflects a disaffiliation with Christian churches, although, of course, nuns disaffiliate from other religions as well. Now, the crucial thing to know about the nuns is that most of them do not reject religious belief as such. Rather, they reject organized religion. In fact, you might think of them as the new Thoreaus. I call them that after the 19th century transcendentalist who similarly fashioned his own highly personal spiritual commitments from a variety of sources. But the new Thoreaus are a mass phenomenon. Henry David Thoreau was one guy out in Concord, but the new Thoreaus are, as I say, well over 60 million of us. And it's a real question whether they can qualify as a religion for legal purposes because they're so divorced from traditional religious communities. And I've written about that elsewhere. But we're not going to talk about that issue so much in this episode. Because Dan's essay argues persuasively that the nuns are not only a religious phenomenon. Being a nun is not only about giving up religious commitments and affiliations, but political and ideological commitments as well. In other words, as sociologist Ryan Burge has written recently, what we're seeing in America today is that a growing share of folks are dropping out of everything. More and more of us are avoiding communal commitments of all kinds and just going our own way. And Dan's essay is all about that phenomenon, and I really want to encourage listeners to read it. It's really an excellent essay, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So Dan, let's get to your essay. You write that the great rival of Christianity since the Enlightenment has been the, quote, religion of progress, unquote, which you say took the form of various isms like communism and fascism and even liberalism. So what do you mean by that exactly?
There are many ways to approach understanding this master concept of progress, which has been so powerful in the Western world and, in fact, all around the planet over the last several centuries. One way of thinking about it, though, is that the tremendous success of modern science, especially the hard sciences, physics, chemistry, and so forth, has created an impression among first Westerners and then increasingly around the entire planet, an impression that the same techniques that we use to improve our material well-being can also be applied to our psychology, our society, our politics, every aspect of human life as well as material existence. And so in some ways, the religion of progress is almost synonymous with, or at least as an aspect of social science. It is the idea that we can take the same sorts of techniques which advanced us in material terms and also advance the whole human race, or at least our part of it, in social terms, in moral terms, psychological terms, and political terms. And that this is a project in which we can have great confidence, which I think is another one of the key elements of this, you know, what I've called a religion of progress, that it's a tremendous faith in humanity based on our knowledge, based on our you know, demonstrated scientific acumen, and this sense that therefore we can, to you know, sort of paraphrase, closely paraphrase Tom Paine, we have it in our power to make the world over again. This has been a regnant idea, not just, you know, on the left or on the right, but across, you know, much of the political spectrum. And it's pervasive. It's something that Westerners in particular have believed in very strongly for several generations. And it's something that around the world, oftentimes inspired by a Western model, sometimes unfortunately by many of the worst Western models, but these Western ideas have propagated and were picked up by a number of non-Western societies, which then also believed if we emulate the West, if we follow the West's path toward some kind of scientific approach to economics, a you know, Western model of government, which unfortunately doesn't always mean a parliamentary form of government. It could also mean, in some cases, a dictatorial form of government. But this idea that modernity meant adopting certain political forms, economic practices, whether capitalist or socialist, and other you know, emulations of what the West was doing, especially secularism, and this idea that you find at the very beginning of modern Pakistan, when Kemal Ataturk creates modern Turkey, when you see it even in, at the beginning of Israel, where there's a contrast between a kind of socialist and secularist side of Zionism and a more religious one. The religious one was actually, I think, the weaker tendency at the founding of the State of Israel. There was this tendency, you know, in all of these different places among rather different civilizational blocks. You see it in India as well. This idea that, you know, you have to have this single idea of a modern state, which is generally going to be secular, scientific, either capitalist or socialist, maybe a mix of the two. But this is what modernity means. It has one particular direction in which it's going. The West has already been there, and we will now want to get there as well.
Well, Dan, I want to get back to something. So you put together three different things here, communism and fascism and liberalism, and you say they're all part of this religion of progress. Actually, now you just mentioned secularism and nationalism too. And of course, a lot of people would object to linking these, especially, you know, if you put liberalism in the same ballpark as communism and fascism, a lot of people would object and say, no, this has nothing to do with those other things. So how would you respond to those objections?
Yeah, I'm not putting those three on the same moral level by any means, but what I am saying is that they all have this vision of progress, and it is all based on the idea that we can have a more scientific approach to our lives. In the case of liberalism, it's often relying upon economic science of, you know, free market, free exchange, and so forth, as well as, you know, a certain understanding of human nature. And, you know, liberalism is, of course, a very broad stream. It's something that has, you know, taken in many influences over the years. There have been unfortunate times when liberalism has taken an interest, for example, in things like eugenics. So, you know, it's even on its own terms, it is a somewhat mixed tradition. But it certainly has this idea that if we get away from the mistakes of the past, we can have a much brighter future. And science is the principle that will allow us to get there. Communism or socialism as a weaker form of communism, they both, I think, begin as a reaction to liberalism. And I think it's fair to say, up to a certain point, that socialists and even communists, or at least Karl Marx, wanted to obtain the same sort of end results that they saw liberals claiming that they also wanted to obtain. This being, you know, a world of infinite prosperity, a world in which everyone could do what they wanted to, you know, at any time of the day. There are passages in Das Kapital and in other works of Marx where if you just selected a couple of sentences or a couple of paragraphs, you might almost think he was a classical liberal himself. But of course, Marx and the you know, communists and socialists, they say that liberalism actually will not get you to this, you know, kind of end of history that the liberals claim to want to reach. That in fact, in order to get there, you need to have a very different approach. You need to have a, first of all, a scientific understanding of history, which liberalism, you know, to some degree, it dabbled with, you know, kind of Hegelian ideas of an idealist end of history, which, you know, kind of recurs over and over. So you've seen Francis Fukuyama offer a version of that in recent decades. But Marxism, of course, had a very firmly fixed, you know, sense of historical development and progression, much more so than liberalism tended to have. And the communists and socialists both thought of themselves as scientific par excellence. They thought that Marxism was a completely respectable, not just economic, but also historical and philosophical science. And so they believed that you could, that the ends that liberals wanted to achieve could only be achieved through quite illiberal means, through using, getting rid of the old aristocracy, getting rid of the old restraints upon free market economics, and then letting the market lead us all to human flourishing, liberation, and prosperity, then in fact, by concentrating workers within cities, you would then get an urban proletariat, even if they, most socialists would not concede this, but I think some would say that even if they materially advanced, they would still be left so far behind the really prosperous millionaires and billionaires that they really wouldn't be able to enjoy the kind of freedom that the wealthy could. And therefore, the communists said, well, you need to, you can't rely on the free market to do this. You have to use state power. And of course, that became a nightmare for the entire world. But that was their thinking. So, a perversion of a number of noble motives get you to socialism and communism. Fascism also, had this idea of scientific progress. It was, unfortunately, in a very evil way, of course, it was all about, racial science, as they, believed it to be. It was all about also sciences. In some ways, forms of fascism are science turned against itself. So many of the fascists, especially in Italy, said, well, the actual best scientific psychology tells us that most human beings are not rational actors, that they, in fact, have this very strong irrational element. And therefore, someone who's able to take advantage of that irrational element could gain power. So fascism is, it comes from a similar background with communism and with liberalism. But it, again, just as communism rejected liberalism, fascism tries to reject both of them in favor of what it claims is now going to be a more scientific and a more realistic vision of the future. And of course, the early Italian fascists were strongly, connected with ideas of futurism. The Nazis, were a very messy movement with, a lunatic at its head. So, of course, there's much less cohesion with the Nazi ideology than there was with the more philosophically worked out Italian fascism. But this general sense of, being on the cutting edge and having science on your side, that was something that, you found both among fascists, but also among socialists and liberals.
Okay, let's stipulate that liberalism and fascism and communism, these other isms, they're all part of this religion of progress that you say. You write in your essay that it's surprising that the rise of the nuns, which again means the weakening of traditional Christianity, hasn't led to the triumph of one of these, specifically liberalism in the United States. And you write, entropy has dethroned progress. It's a nice line. So why is it surprising that the rise of the nuns hasn't led to the triumph of liberalism? Why do you think that's surprising?
Well, I'm alluding there to this rather hackneyed idea of often called the secularization thesis, which says that as a society abandons its traditional religion, it will become more advanced, it'll become more liberal in one sense or another. This was a prejudice that was deeply ingrained in a lot of liberal thinkers throughout most of the 20th century. I think even now you see, many who still, adhere to it. Now, of course, these different ideologies, especially, socialism and liberalism, they had different understandings of what secularization would lead to. And so liberals were not, by any stretch, the only, ideology which believed in that secularization would inevitably lead in the direction they wanted history to go. But liberalism did, or at least many liberals had that prejudice. They did have that belief that, as you abandon, the forms of religion, which, maybe it was against religion as a whole, or maybe it was simply against a more involuntary or, so older variety of religion. But this idea that as, freedom flourishes, people might become less religious, as they become more scientifically literate. And, there's this, again, prejudicial belief, which is, I think, strongly ingrained in people all across, a swath of different ideologies, that science will have this kind of demystifying effect and will move people away from religion simply because Again, there's this prejudicial belief that science and religion are incompatible. So this, belief was something that I think you found among a great many, especially center-left liberals in the United States and in the Western world, in the late 20th century and even into the beginning of this century. Now, when I say that entropy has dethroned progress, just recently there was a interesting remark by Richard Dawkins, and Dawkins is himself a scientist. He is an outspoken atheist. He is, I think it would be fair to say, a broadly speaking in, the political center, perhaps even a liberal of some kind, maybe a mix of liberal and perhaps a little bit of socialism. I don't know his politics extremely well, but in general, he seems like a figure who would think of himself as and be widely identified as an Enlightenment man. And recently, he made some remarks around Easter time saying that he was dismayed that in England, there seemed to be less celebration of Easter than there was of Ramadan, and that Islam had a more stronger presence in the public square than Christianity did. And even though Dawkins has made a kind of second career for himself as an atheist and a critic of Christianity, he still feels a tremendous sentimental attachment to Christianity, and he was kind of shocked to see that actually what comes after Christianity in England might not be secularism, might not be the kind of Richard Dawkins Enlightenment, but may in fact be Islam or maybe a mix of different religions. I think many liberals and many people who identify strongly with the ethos of the Enlightenment are finding themselves in the same position today, that in fact the future does not look the way they imagined it would, that in fact one of the key pinnacles or principles rather of liberalism, which is pluralism, pluralism creates the possibility of a kind of discontinuous history, that you have no idea, whether it's going to be Islam or secularism or, perhaps some new, paganism or, a resurgence of, a very hardline Catholicism with integralism or a mix of all these things that may, in fact, be characteristic of the American society of the future and Hinduism and other things. It could all be, put in there together. If you combine the ideas of pluralism and the secularization thesis, it would seem as if you could welcome into society people with a variety of different religious views, a variety of different philosophical backgrounds, and it'll all even out eventually through secularization and wind up either with liberalism or socialism or some consensus that is born of the Enlightenment. And in fact, what we're actually seeing as a historical fact is that this is not the case. That when you have a mix of different religions, sometimes those religions, instead of moving towards secularization, actually become stronger. And they may actually, through a sense of rivalry, perhaps, or a sense of the need to articulate their views more forcefully in a society which is, so cacophonous, perhaps, and so has so many different voices, that they start to project their own voices more loudly. And I think you see, various kinds of, more, militantly in the sense of psychologically militant rather than, I'm not talking about, violence or anything like that. But you certainly see a kind of more hardline form of religion that is being promulgated in a lot of places. And that's coming from, whether it's Islam, whether it's certain forms of, Catholicism, like integralism. You see versions of this among Protestants, perhaps with Christian nationalism. But this is not the future that Enlightenment men like Richard Dawkins imagined.
So that's very interesting, Dan. And so that leads to another, I think, pretty obvious question. So what happened? Why hasn't this worked out the way everyone would have thought? I mean, if we're correct that Christianity is gradually ceding ground to these other things, was meant to be ceding ground to this religion of progress, what has happened? Why hasn't that happened?
Well, it was simply a mistaken thesis from the very beginning. This hypothesis that progress in the material world had to translate into the same kind of progress, linear, unidirectional, within the world of politics, the world of religion, society as a whole. The question was begged from the very beginning. And what we're seeing now is that we actually have evidence that is starting to disprove this hypothesis. And again, a scientist would actually say, well, you have to take account of the evidence, and that seems to cut against the hypothesis, so maybe you have to abandon it. But because there was this religious intensity, I think it's fair to say, in this belief in progress, the attitude even of people who were formed by scientific thought or scientific prejudices, people like Richard Dawkins, they are actually shocked and disillusioned by what's happening. It's like a loss of faith as opposed to, you know, this is simply a disproved hypothesis and now we move on to the next one. So even the conceit that we are a scientific, an enlightened scientific public and an enlightened scientific Western world, this too was something where we were kind of fooling ourselves. And now that we're seeing evidence to the contrary, we realize actually these were values that we cherished. And in many cases, they were values actually derived from Christianity, even if people were giving up the explicit forms of Christianity while trying to maintain the values. And again, I point to Dawkins as a great example here because he still has this very strong emotional attachment, not just to, I think, the Christmas carols of his youth, but also probably to the emotional matrix that Christianity represented throughout his life. And I think he's now starting to realize that actually, when you get rid of Christianity, those other elements, not just the Christmas carols, but also many of the values that you long associated with Christianity, they might also be transformed or lost.
Yeah, that's really very interesting. And I like this idea that you've put forth that actually what comes after a traditional Christianity might not be progress, it might be entropy, it might be confusion. Now, I want to talk about something else. So this has all been very ideological, very intellectual, but I want to talk a little bit sociologically. And you don't talk about this in your essay, to be fair, but I still want to ask you. Another aspect here of the nuns is giving up communal commitments. So it's not just giving up a kind of logical, coherent, systematic faith in something. It's giving up communities. It's giving up the sense that one goes to church, one belongs to something beyond oneself. Why is that happening, do you? I mean, why are we, the famous phrase that Robert Putnam used was bowling alone, and this is like 20 years ago now, that, you know, Americans were no longer joining things. That also seems to be connected with the end of the religion of progress, so to speak. So do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, sometimes what is progress in one respect can be socially transformative in ways that people may find destructive in other respects. In the case of Bowling Alone and this transformation of American civic participation or participation in everything from bowling leagues to the Shriners, a lot of that, I think, has to do with the recomposition of the workforce in terms of gender. So for a very long time, even though women were not, you know, greatly represented in the workforce, they were the bulwarks of church associations. And a lot of American religion, a lot of the charitable work that was being done by religion was done by women who were not in the, you know, the formal workforce, who were not, you know, receiving a salary. As that changed, and there was also a tendency because women, had a very strong representation in these church organizations and others, there was a tendency for men to then, you know, create organizations kind of in parallel, especially if they felt the need to, you know, I don't want to say counterbalance, but it's more of a sense that there were just things that men wanted to do that maybe it may have been different from what women wanted to do. And therefore they formed these, you know, quite, you know, strongly sexually, you know, self-segregated kinds of organs of civil society. The integration of the workforce with both sexes now, I think has, you know, sort of erased a lot of those, first of all, the opportunities and the free time that women had previously to invest in things like church groups. But obviously, you know, there's much more going on as well. And, you know, new technologies and the global economy, all of that has had a fragmenting effect upon Americans. These things have benefits. You know, they may mean less expensive goods. They may mean more job opportunities. But they also mean that you have, you know, sort of less need to be connected strongly with your local community. It doesn't matter so much if you know the manager of the bowling alley, if you want to get your nephew hired or something. Now what's important is, do you know an admissions officer who can get him, you know, admitted to, you know, a university and, you know, that's going to then provide a job in a very different location or perhaps even a different country. So all of these forces, which, you know, have a good rationale, a good background behind them, whether it's an educational advancement or whether it's, you know, economic globalization, they have this downside that they all tend to be centrifugal. They all tend to pull people away from the, you know, sort of old organic connections they used to have. And of course, this is very much true with the internet and with social media and with smartphones too.
Yeah, that's really very interesting. I caught the word you said there, fragmentation. And I think so I guess we could say it this way, right? That what seems to be happening is a fragmenting both of ideology, or at least of systematic ideology, and also a fragmenting of society more generally. And maybe that's what comes after the traditional Christianity of the last, you know, in America, the last couple hundred years. Maybe that's what it comes down to. We really are seeing just a general, I said dropping out at the top of the podcast, maybe just a general fragmentation. So Dan, Modern Age is a conservative journal, and you've written that the rise of the nuns poses risks for conservatism as well as liberalism. We talked a lot about liberalism in the episode, but what risks do you think that the rise of the nuns poses for conservatism exactly? You write at the end of your essay, quote, "Conservatives must restore the willingness to make the right kind of grand commitments." So I guess given what you just said about fragmentation, I wonder, is that a realistic goal, especially for conservatism, which often thinks of itself as not being about systematic commitments? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, conservatives take for granted, as the name itself implies, that there is something to conserve. And generally that thing to be conserved is a broad society, whether it's a nation as a whole, you know, whether it's a historic identity, a historic, you know, religion of a nation. But all of these sort of large and, you know, sort of well-established social sets of connections, these are, you know, the things that conservatives have traditionally wanted to conserve. An age that is entropic like our own then calls into question, well, what does it mean to be a conservative? I think there are several answers to that. One answer may be, well, if you have lost the common ground that you used to previously want to conserve, you now have to reestablish, you know, the common ground, perhaps, you know, through, bullying people into taking up the views you want them to take. So that, I think, gives you a very hard line, not necessarily conservative kind of conservatism, but instead, a more, you know, revolutionary or counter-revolutionary kind of conservatism. And again, I'm talking, you know, here about, you know, the psychological and political intensity of a movement, not necessarily, you know, violence in the street or anything like that. But this, I think, is one path through which you get some of the kinds of conservatism that trouble many people today. You could also say, well, look, you may have an erosion of the, you know, establishments that conservatives have traditionally wanted to conserve. However, that doesn't mean that faster is better than slower. So even if you are fighting, you know, you're like King Canute against the waves, to the extent you can, you know, throw back a little bit of water, that's still worth doing. So that kind of conservatism, you know, would perhaps lend itself to if not defeatism, certainly a sense that evolution and the slow change of society is something to be accepted, in some cases even to be welcomed, but it should be slow change as opposed to the very rapid change that we may be experiencing now. I think there's also a conservatism of denial, which just says, well, look, in fact, we still have the kind of society that we had, you know, half a century ago, and that it's only because the wrong people are in political office that it seems like we have this drift away from older, you know, notions of America, older notions of who we are as a society. And if only you put the right people in office, or if only if only people would read the right books, then all of this could be reversed. I think that's wrong. I do think it's, you know, that is a conservatism of denial, but it's an understandable impulse psychologically.
I guess so. I mean, I think, you know, if you're right, if we're right in this episode that what's going on is fragmentation and entropy, I'm not sure you have enough purchase with people to, you said bully. I know you don't condone the bullying conservatism, but even persuading people might be very difficult because people just will tune you out and go listen to something else. There isn't the kind of, you know, sense of audience that you have where you can persuade people, okay, now we're all going to join a great commitment. I mean, that might be a real problem, no?
Well, it's a problem if you think in terms of mass democracy, but it may not be a problem because fragmentation will apply to both sides. So it will apply to someone who wants to create a consensus of their own, but it also applies to a counter consensus. So there may be less resistance to small groups trying to, you know, force their views on people in the future, simply because the resistance also has to be relatively cohesive and has to have some common ground. To give an example of this, I mean, when you talk to older conservatives, and it's not because they're less religious or because they, you know, think of themselves as, you know, classical liberals, but if you talk to a lot of older conservatives, they will take for granted things like, you know, the West stood for freedom during the Cold War, and that was a good thing, or that, you know, we should be standing up for free speech and freedom of expression in the universities. If you talk to a lot of younger conservatives, they don't have that, those, you know, prejudices in the good sense, one might say. They don't take those things for granted. And instead, you know, they are questioning things that conservatives of an older generation had simply assumed. So I think that, you know, the conservatives can still have a lot of political success in the age of entropy. And in some ways, because conservatives have been on the back foot for a long time, and you've actually had, you know, a certainly, you know, since the 1990s, a form of, you know, left liberalism or progressivism has been marching through our institutions. There may even be, you know, a conservative resurgence, because conservatives may be sort of more adapted at this point to fragmentation than progressives who are now, you know, and people who, you know, still talk about liberal democracy who are shocked. I think Francis Fukuyama and, you know, and other folks may be shocked by the conditions today, or Richard Dawkins is shocked. Whereas a lot of conservatives have said for a long time, well, we are against the age. We are, you know, a remnant that is, you know, fighting against the tide. They're accustomed to this, and that may actually make them more effective in a world of greater fragmentation.
Well, that's very interesting, Dan. I guess we'll leave it there. I want to thank you, Dan, again for coming on and talking about your essay. And I want to encourage listeners to go to Modern Age and read Dan's essay, which we talked about today, The Other Nuns, which I think is really very interesting. And we'll just have to see how it all develops. And maybe, Dan, we'll have you back on to talk about this in the future, too. But thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
And that's it for this episode of Legal Spirits. I want to say again to our listeners that you can find past episodes archived on our website, which is lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes and Spotify and other streaming platforms. If you like us, please subscribe. But that's it for this episode. See you next time.